having to reconfigure the entire library. Genes may have appeared for the same reason. Discrete information-bearing modules in one strand of RNA were used to encode instructions to fulfill discrete and individual functions. The discontinuous nature of information would have carried an added benefit. A mutation could affect one gene and only one gene, leaving the other genes unaffected. Mutations could now act on discrete modules of information rather than disrupting the function of the organism as a whole, thereby accelerating evolution. But that benefit came with a concomitant liability. Too much mutation and the information would be damaged or lost. What was needed, perhaps, was a backup copy, a mirror image to protect the original or to restore the prototype if damaged. Perhaps this was the ultimate impetus to create a double-stranded nucleic acid. The data in one strand would be perfectly reflected in the other and could be used to restore anything damaged. The yin would protect the yang. Life thus invented its own hard drive. In time, this new copy, DNA, would become the master copy. DNA was an invention of the RNA world, but it soon overran RNA as a carrier of genes and became the dominant bearer of genetic information in living systems. Yet another ancient myth of the child consuming its father, of Cronus, overthrown by Zeus, is etched into the history of our genomes. Part 6. Postgenome. The genetics of fate and future. Those who promise us paradise on earth never produced anything but a hell. Karl Popper. It's only we humans who want to own the future, too. Tom Stoppard, The Coast of Utopia. The future of the future. Probably no DNA science is at once as hopeful, controversial, hyped, and even as potentially dangerous as the discipline known as gene therapy. Gina Smith, The Genomics Age. Let us return for a moment to a conversation on the ramparts of a fort. It is the late summer of 1972. We are in Sicily at a scientific conference on genetics. It is late at night, and Paul Berg and a group of students have clambered up a hill overlooking the lights of a city. Berg's news of the possibility of combining two pieces of DNA to create recombinant DNA has sent tremors of wonder and anxiety through the meeting. At the conference, the students are concerned about the dangers of such novel DNA fragments. If the wrong gene is introduced into the wrong organism, the experiment might unleash a biological or ecological catastrophe. But Berg's interlocutors aren't particularly worried about pathogens. They have gone, as students often do, to the heart of the matter. They want to know about the prospects of human genetic engineering, of new genes being introduced permanently into the human genome. What about predicting the future from genes and then altering that destiny through genetic manipulation? They were already thinking several steps ahead, Berg later told me. I was worried about the future, but they were worried about the future of the future. For a while, the future of the future seemed biologically intractable. In 1974, barely 3 years after the invention of recombinant DNA technology, a gene-modified SV40 virus was used to infect early mouse embryonic cells. The plan was audacious. The virus-infected embryonic cells were mixed with the cells of a normal embryo to create a composite of cells, an embryological chimera. These composite embryos were implanted into mice. All the organs and cells of the embryo emanated from that mix of cells: blood, brain, guts, heart, muscles, and, most crucially, the sperm in the eggs. If the virally infected embryonic cells formed some of the sperm in the egg cells of the newborn mice, then the viral genes would be transmitted from mouse to mouse vertically across generations like any other gene. The virus, like a Trojan horse, might thus smuggle genes permanently into an animal's genome across multiple generations, resulting in the first genetically modified higher organism. The experiment worked at first, but it was stymied by two unexpected effects. First, although cells carrying viral genes clearly emerged in the blood, muscle, brain, and nerves of the mouse, the delivery of the viral genes into sperm and eggs was extremely inefficient. Try as they might, scientists could not achieve efficient vertical transmission of the genes across generations. And second, even though viral genes were present in the mouse cells, the expression of the genes was firmly shut down, resulting in an inert gene that did not make RNA or protein. Years later, scientists would discover that epigenetic marks had been placed on viral genes to silence them. We now know that cells have ancient detectors that recognize viral genes and stamp them with chemical marks, like cancellation signs, to prevent their activation. The genome had, it seemed, already anticipated attempts to alter it. It was a perfect stalemate. There's an old proverb among magicians that it's essential to learn to make things reappear before one learns to make things disappear. Gene therapists were relearning that lesson. It was easy to slip a gene invisibly into a cell and into an embryo. The real challenge was to make it visible again. Thwarted by these original studies, the field of gene therapy stagnated for another decade or so, until biologists stumbled on a critical discovery: embryonic stem cells, or ES cells. To understand the future of gene therapy in humans, we need to reckon with ES cells. Consider an organ such as the brain or the skin. As an animal ages, cells on the surface of its skin grow, die, and slough off. This wave of cell death might even be catastrophic, after a burn or a massive wound, for instance. To replace these dead cells, most organs must possess methods to regenerate their own cells. Stem cells fulfill this function, especially after catastrophic cell loss. A stem cell is a unique type of cell that is defined by two properties. It can give rise to other functional cell types, such as nerve cells or skin cells, through differentiation. And it can renew itself, that is, give rise to more stem cells, which can, in turn, differentiate to form the functional cells of an organ. A stem cell is somewhat akin to a grandfather that continues to produce children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, generation upon generation, without ever losing his own reproductive fecundity. It is the ultimate reservoir of regeneration for a tissue or an organ. Most stem cells reside in particular organs and tissues and give rise to a limited repertoire of cells. Stem cells in the bone marrow, for instance, only produce blood cells. There are stem cells in the crypts of the intestine that are dedicated to the production of intestinal cells. But embryonic stem cells, or ES cells, which arise from the inner sheath of an animal's embryo, are vastly more potent. They can give rise to every cell type in the organism: blood, brains, intestines, muscles, bone, skin. Biologists use the word pluripotent to describe this property of ES cells. ES cells also possess an unusual third characteristic, a quirk of nature. They can be isolated from the embryo of an organism and grown in petri dishes in the lab. The cells grow continuously in culture, tiny, translucent spheres that can cluster into nest-like whorls under the microscope. They resemble a dissolving organ more than an organism in the making. Indeed, when the cells were first derived from mouse embryos in a laboratory in Cambridge, England, in the early 80s, they generated little interest among geneticists. "Nobody seems to be interested in my cells," the embryologist Martin Evans complained. But the real power of an ES cell lies yet again in a transition. Like DNA, like genes, and like viruses, it is the intrinsic duality of its existence that makes this cell such a potent biological tool. Embryonic stem cells behave like other experimentally amenable cells in tissue culture. They can be grown in petri dishes. They can be frozen in vials and thawed back to life. The cells can be propagated in liquid broth for generations, and genes can be inserted into their genomes or excised from their genomes with relative ease. Yet, put the same cell into the right environment, in the right context, and life literally leaps out of it. Mixed with cells from an early embryo and implanted into a mouse womb, the cells divide and form layers. They differentiate into all sorts of cells: blood, brain, muscle, liver, and even sperm and egg cells. These cells, in turn, organize themselves into organs and then become incorporated, miraculously, into a multi-layered, multicellular organism, an actual mouse. Every experimental manipulation performed in the petri dish is thus carried forward into this mouse. The genetic modification of a cell in a dish becomes the genetic modification of an organism in a womb, It is a transition between lab and life. The experimental ease permitted by embryonic stem cells also surmounted a second and more intractable problem. When viruses are used to deliver genes into cells, it is virtually impossible to control where the gene is inserted into the genome. At 3 billion base pairs of DNA, the human genome is about 50,000 or 100,000 times the size of most viral genomes. A viral gene drops into the genome like a candy wrapper thrown from an airplane into the Atlantic. There is no way to predict where it might land. Virtually all viruses capable of gene integration, such as HIV or SV40, generally latch their genes randomly onto some spot in the human genome. For gene therapy, this random integration is an infernal nuisance. The viral genes might fall into a silenced crevasse of the genome, never to be expressed. The genes might fall into an area of the chromosome that is actively silenced by the cell without much effort. Or worse, the integration might disrupt an essential gene or activate a cancer-causing gene, resulting in potential disasters. With ES cells, however, scientists learned to make genetic changes not randomly, but in targeted positions in the genome, including within the genes themselves. You could choose to change the insulin gene and, through some rather basic but ingenious experimental manipulations, ensure that only the insulin gene was changed in the cells. And because the gene-modified ES cells could, in principle, generate all the cell types in a full mouse, you could be sure that a mouse with precisely that changed insulin gene would be born. Indeed, if the gene-modified ES cells eventually produced sperm and egg cells in the adult mice, then the gene would be transmitted from mouse to mouse across generations, thus achieving vertical hereditary transmission. This technology had far-reaching implications. In the natural world, the only means to achieve a directional or intentional change in a gene is through random mutation and natural selection. If you expose an animal to X-rays, say, a genetic alteration might become permanently embedded in the genome, but there is no method to focus the attention of an X-ray to one particular gene. Natural selection must choose the mutation that confers the best fitness to the organism, and thereby allows that mutation to become increasingly common in the gene pool. But in this scheme, neither mutation nor evolution has any intentionality or directionality. In nature, the engine that drives genetic alteration has no one in its driver's seat. The watchmaker of evolution, as Richard Dawkins reminds us, is inherently blind. Using ES cells, however, a scientist could intentionally manipulate virtually any chosen gene and incorporate that genetic change permanently into the genome of an animal. It was mutation and selection in the same step, evolution fast-forward in a laboratory dish. The technology was so transformative that a new word had to be coined to describe these organisms. They were called transgenic animals from across genes. By the early 1990s, hundreds of strains of transgenic mice had been created in laboratories around the world to decipher the functions of genes. One mouse was made with a jellyfish gene inserted into its genome that allowed it to glow in the dark under blue lamps. Other mice, carrying variants of the growth hormone gene, grew twice the size of their normal counterparts. There were mice endowed with genetic alterations that forced them to develop Alzheimer's disease, epilepsy, or premature aging. Mice with activated cancer genes exploded with tumors, allowing biologists to use these mice as models for human malignancies. In 2014, researchers created a mouse carrying a mutation in a gene that controls the communication between neurons in the brain. These mice have substantially increased memory and superior cognitive function. They are the savants of the rodent world. They acquire memories faster, retain them longer, and learn new tasks nearly twice as fast as normal mice. The experiments brimmed over with complex ethical implications. Could this technique be used in primates, in humans? Who would regulate the creation of animals with transgenes? What genes would be or could be introduced? What were the limits on transgenes? Fortunately, technical barriers intervened before the ethical mayhem had a chance to become unmoored. Much of the original work on ES cells, including the production of transgenic organisms, had been performed using mouse cells. In the early 1990s, when several human embryonic stem cells were derived from early human embryos, scientists ran into an unexpected barrier. Unlike the mouse ES cells, which had proved so amenable to experimental manipulations, human ES cells did not behave themselves in culture. It may be the field's dirty little secret. Human ES cells do not have the same capabilities as mouse ES cells, the biologist Rudolf Janisch said. You can't clone them. You can't use them for gene targeting. They are very different from mouse embryonic stem cells, which can do everything. At least temporarily, the genie of transgenesis seemed contained. Transgenic modification of human embryos was out of the question for a while, but what if gene therapists could settle for a less radical goal? Could viruses be used to deliver genes into human non-reproductive cells, i.e. to neurons, blood, or muscle cells? The problem of random integration into the genome would remain, and most crucially, no vertical transmission of genes from one organism to the next would occur. But if the virally delivered genes could be put into the right kind of cells, they might still achieve their therapeutic purpose. Even that goal would represent a leap into the future of human medicine. It would be gene therapy light. In 1988, a 2-year-old girl named Ashanti De Silva, or Ashi for short, in North Olmsted, Ohio, began to develop peculiar symptoms. Children have dozens of transient ailments in infancy, as any parent knows. But Ashi's illnesses and symptoms were markedly abnormal. Bizarre pneumonias and infections that seemed to persist, wounds that would not heal, and a white blood cell count that hovered consistently below normal. Much of Ashi's childhood was spent in and out of the hospital. At age 2, a run-of-the-mill viral infection spun out of control, causing life-threatening internal bleeding and a prolonged hospitalization. For a while, her doctors were mystified by her symptoms, attributing her periodic illnesses loosely to an underdeveloped immune system that would eventually mature. But when the symptoms refused to abate as Ashi turned 3, she underwent a barrage of tests. Her immunodeficiency was attributed to her genes, to rare, spontaneous mutations in both copies of a gene called ADA on chromosome 20. By then, Ashi had already suffered several near-death experiences. The physical toll on her body had been immense, but the emotional anguish that she had experienced was more pronounced. One morning, the 4-year-old awoke and said, "Mommy, you shouldn't have had a child like me." The ADA gene, short for adenosine deaminase, encodes an enzyme that converts adenosine, a natural chemical produced by the body, into a harmless product called inosine. In the absence of the ADA gene, the detoxification reaction fails to occur and the body gets clogged with toxic byproducts of adenosine metabolism. The cells that are most acutely poisoned are infection-fighting T cells, and in their absence, the immune system collapses rapidly. The illness is fleetingly rare. Only 1 in 150,000 children is born with ADA deficiency, but it is even rarer still because virtually all children die of the disease. ADA deficiency is part of a larger group of notorious illnesses called severe combined immunodeficiency, or SCID. The most famous SCID patient, a boy named David Vetter, had spent all 12 years of his life in a plastic chamber in a Texas hospital. The bubble boy, as David was called by the media, died in 1984, still imprisoned in his sterile plastic bubble, after a desperate attempt at a bone marrow transplant. David Vetter's death gave pause to doctors who had hoped to use bone marrow transplants to treat ADA deficiency. The only other medicine being tested in early clinical trials in the mid-80s was called PEG-ADA, the purified enzyme derived from cows and wrapped in an oily chemical sheath to make it long-lived in the blood. The normal ADA protein is too short-lived to be effective. But even PEG-ADA barely reversed the immunodeficiency. It had to be injected into the blood every month or so to replace the enzyme degraded by the body. More ominously, PEG-ADA carried the risk of inducing antibodies against itself, depleting the levels of the enzyme even more acutely and precipitating a full catastrophe, making the solution infinitely worse than the original problem. Could gene therapy correct ADA deficiency? After all, only one gene needed to be corrected, and the gene had already been identified and isolated. A vehicle or vector designed to deliver genes into human cells had also been identified. In Boston, Richard Mulligan, a virologist and geneticist, had designed a particular strain of retrovirus, a cousin of HIV's, that could potentially shuttle any gene into any human cell with relative safety. Retroviruses can be designed to infect many kinds of cells. Their distinct capability is their ability to insert their own genome into the cell's genome, thereby permanently affixing their genetic material to that of a cell. By tweaking the technology, Mulligan had created partially crippled viruses that would infect cells and integrate into their genomes, but would not propagate the infection from cell to cell. Virus went in, but no virus came out. The gene fell into the genome, but never popped out again. In 1986, at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, a team of gene therapists, led by William French Anderson and Michael Blaze, decided to use variants of Mulligan's vectors to deliver the ADA gene into children with ADA deficiency. Anderson obtained the ADA gene from another lab and inserted it into the retroviral gene delivery vector. In the early 1980s, Anderson and Blaze had run some preliminary trials hoping to use retroviral vectors to deliver the human ADA gene into blood-forming stem cells of mice and then monkeys. Once these stem cells had been infected by the virus carrying the ADA gene, Anderson hoped they would form all the cellular elements of blood, including, crucially, T cells, into which the now functioning ADA gene had been delivered. The results were far from promising. The level of gene delivery was abysmal. Of the five monkeys treated, only one, Monkey Roberts, had cells in the blood that showed long-term production of the human ADA protein from the virus-delivered gene. But Anderson was unfazed. "Nobody knows what may happen when new genes enter the body of a human being," he argued. "It's a total black box. Despite what anyone tells you, test tube and animal research can only tell us so much. Eventually, you have to try it in a person." On April 24, 1987, Anderson and Blaze applied to the NIH for permission to launch their gene therapy protocol. They proposed to extract bone marrow stem cells from the children with ADA deficiency, infect the cells with the virus in the lab, and transplant the modified cells back into the patients. Since the stem cells generate all the elements of blood, including B and T cells, the ADA gene would find its way into the T cells, where it was most required. The proposal was sent to the Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee, or RAC, a consortium set up within the NIH in the wake of the Berg recommendations of the Asilomar meeting. Known for its tough oversight, the advisory committee was the gatekeeper for all experiments that involved recombinant DNA. The committee was so notoriously obstreperous that researchers called getting its approval being taken through the rack. Perhaps predictably, the RAC rejected the protocol outright, citing the poor animal data, the barely detectable level of gene delivery into stem cells, and the lack of a detailed experimental rationale, while noting that gene transfer into a human body had never been attempted before. Anderson and Blaze returned to the lab to revamp their protocol. Begrudgingly, they admitted that the RAC's decision was correct. The barely detectable infection rate of bone marrow stem cells by the gene-carrying virus was clearly a problem, and the animal data was far from exhilarating. But if stem cells could not be used, how could gene therapy hope to succeed? Stem cells are the only cells in the body that can renew themselves and therefore provide a long-term solution to a gene deficiency. Without a source of self-renewing or long-lived cells, you might insert genes into the human body, but the cells carrying the genes would eventually die and vanish. There would be genes, but no therapy. That winter, mulling over the problem, Blaze found a potential solution. What if, rather than delivering the genes into the blood-forming stem cells, they merely took T cells from the blood of ADA patients and put the virus into the cells? It would not be as radical or permanent an experiment as putting viruses into stem cells, but it would be far less toxic and much easier to achieve clinically. The T cells could be harvested from peripheral blood, not bone marrow, and the cells might live just long enough to make the ADA protein and correct the deficiency. Although the T cells would inevitably fade from the blood, the procedure could be repeated again and again, It would not qualify as definitive gene therapy, but it would still be a proof of principle. Gene therapy, double light. Anderson was reluctant. If he was to launch the first trial of human gene therapy, he wanted a definitive trial and a chance to stake a permanent claim on medical history. He resisted at first, but eventually, conceding Blaze's logic, relented. In 1990, Anderson and Blaze approached the committee again. Again, there was vicious dissent. The T-cell protocol had even less supportive data than the original. Anderson and Blaze submitted modifications, and modifications to the modifications. Months passed without a decision. In the summer of 1990, after a prolonged series of debates, the committee agreed to let them proceed with the trial. "Doctors have been waiting for this day for 1,000 years, the RAC's chairman, Gerard McGarrity, said. Most others in the committee were not as sanguine about the chances of success. Anderson and Blaze searched hospitals around the country to find children with ADA deficiency for their trial. They came upon a small trove in Ohio, all of 2 patients with the genetic defect. One was a tall, dark-haired girl named Cynthia Cutshaw. The second, Ashanti De Silva, was a 4-year-old daughter of a chemist and a nurse, both from Sri Lanka. In September 1990, on an overcast morning in Bethesda, Van and Raja De Silva, Ashi's parents, brought their daughter to the NIH. Ashi was now 4 years old, a shy, hesitant girl with a fringe of shiny hair, cut pageboy style, and an apprehensive face that could suddenly be brightened by a smile. This was her first meeting with Anderson and Blaze. When they approached her, she looked away. Anderson brought her down to the hospital's gift shop and asked her to pick out a soft toy for herself. She chose a bunny. Back at the clinical center, Anderson inserted a catheter into one of Ashi's veins, collected samples of her blood, and rushed it up to his lab. Over the next 4 days, 200 million retroviruses, in an enormous cloudy soup, were mixed with 200 million T-cells drawn from Ashi's blood. Once infected, the cells grew in petri dishes, forming lush outcroppings of new cells and even newer cells. They doubled by day and doubled by night in a silent, humid incubator in Building 10 of the clinical center. Just a few hundred feet from the lab where Marshall Nirenberg, almost exactly 25 years before, had solved the genetic code. Ashi De Silva's gene-modified T-cells were ready on September 14, 1990. That morning, Anderson ran out of his home at dawn, skipping breakfast, near nauseous with anticipation, and dashed up the steps to the lab on the 3rd floor. The De Silva family was already waiting for him. Ashi was standing by her mother, her elbows planted firmly on her seated mother's lap, as if waiting for a dental exam. The morning was spent running more tests. The clinic was silent, except for the occasional footfall of research nurses running in and out. As Ashi sat on her bed, in a loose yellow gown, a needle was put into one of her veins. She winced slightly, but recovered. Her veins had been cannulated dozens of times before. At 12:52 p.m., a vinyl bag carrying the murky swirl of nearly 1 billion T-cells infected by the ADA gene-carrying retrovirus was brought up to the floor. Ashi looked apprehensively at the bag as the nurses hooked it to her vein. 28 minutes later, the bag had run dry, its last dregs emptied into Ashi. She played with a yellow sponge ball on her bed. Her vital signs were normal. Ashi's father was sent downstairs with a pile of quarters to buy candy from the vending machine on the ground floor. Anderson looked visibly relieved. "A cosmic moment has come and gone with scarcely a sign of its magnitude," one observer wrote. "It was celebrated in style with a bag of multicolored M&Ms. "Number 1, Anderson said, pointing elatedly at Ashi as he wheeled her down the hallway after the transfusion had been completed. A few of his colleagues at the NIH were waiting outside the door to witness the coming of the first human to be transfused with gene-modified cells, but the crowd thinned quickly, and the scientists vanished back to their labs. "It's like people say in downtown Manhattan," Anderson groused. "Jesus Christ himself could walk by and nobody would notice." The next day, Ashi's family returned home to Ohio. Did Anderson's gene therapy experiment work? We do not know, and perhaps we will never know. Anderson's protocol was designed as a proof of principle for safety. That is, could retrovirus-infected T-cells be safely delivered into human bodies? It was not designed to test efficacy. Would this protocol cure ADA deficiency, even temporarily? Ashi De Silva and Cynthia Cutshall, the first two patients on the study, received the gene-modified T-cells, but they were allowed continued treatment with PEG-ADA, the artificial enzyme. Any effect of the gene therapy was thus confounded by that medicine. Nonetheless, both De Silva's and Cutshall's parents were convinced that the treatment worked. It's not a big improvement, Cynthia Cutshall's mother admitted. But to give you an example, she just got over one cold. Usually her colds end up in pneumonia. This one didn't. That's a breakthrough for her. Ashi's father, Raja De Silva, concurred. With PEG, we'd seen a tremendous improvement. But even with PEG ADA, she had runny noses and a constant cold, was on antibiotics all the time. But by the second infusion of genes in December, it began to change. We noticed because we were not using up so many boxes of tissues. Despite Anderson's enthusiasm and the anecdotal evidence from the families, many proponents of gene therapy, including Mulligan, were far from convinced that Anderson's trial had amounted to anything more than a publicity stunt. Mulligan, the most voluble critic of the trial from the very first, was particularly incensed by the claims of success when the data was insufficient. If the most ambitious gene therapy trial attempted in humans was going to be measured in the frequency of runny noses and boxes of Kleenex, then it would be an embarrassment for the field. "It's a sham," Mulligan told a journalist when asked about the protocol. To test whether targeted genetic alterations could be introduced into human cells, and whether these genes would confer normal function safely and effectively, he proposed a careful, uncontaminated trial. Clean, chaste gene therapy, as he called it. But by then, the ambitions of gene therapists had been frothed to such frenzy that clean, chaste, careful experiments had become virtually impossible to perform. Following the reports of the T-cell trials at the NIH, gene therapists envisioned novel cures for genetic diseases such as cystic fibrosis and Huntington's disease. Since genes could be delivered into virtually any cellular disease was a candidate for gene therapy. Heart disease? Mental illness? Cancer? As the field readied itself to sprint forward, voices such as Mulligan's urged caution and restraint, but they were brushed aside. The enthusiasm would come at a steep price. It would bring the field of gene therapy and human genetics to the brink of disaster, and to the lowest, bleakest point in its scientific history. On September 9, 1999, almost exactly 9 years after Ashi De Silva had been treated with genetically modified white blood cells, a boy named Jesse Gelsinger flew to Philadelphia to enroll in another gene therapy trial. Gelsinger was 18 years old. A motorcycling and wrestling enthusiast with an easy, carefree manner, Gelsinger, like Ashi De Silva and Cynthia Cutshall, was also born with a mutation in a single gene involved in metabolism. In Gelsinger's case, the gene was called ornithine transcarbamylase, or OTC, which encodes an enzyme synthesized in the liver. OTC, the enzyme, performs a critical step in the breakdown of proteins. In the absence of the enzyme, ammonia, a byproduct of protein metabolism, accumulates in the body. Ammonia, the chemical found in cleaning fluid, damages blood vessels and cells, diffuses past the blood-brain barrier, and ultimately results in the slow poisoning of neurons in the brain. Most patients with mutations in OTC do not survive childhood. Even with strictly protein-free diets, they are poisoned by the breakdown of their own cells as they grow. Among children born with an unfortunate disease, Gelsinger might have counted himself as especially fortunate, for his variant of OTC deficiency was mild. The mutation in his gene had not come from his father or his mother, but had occurred spontaneously in one of his cells in utero, probably when he was still a young embryo. Genetically, Gelsinger was a rare phenomenon, a human chimera, a patchwork cellular quilt with some cells lacking functional OTC and some with a working gene. Still, his ability to metabolize proteins was severely compromised. Gelsinger lived on a carefully calibrated diet, every calorie and portion weighed, measured, and accounted for, and took 32 pills a day to keep his ammonia level in check. Despite such extreme cautionary measures, Gelsinger had still suffered several life-threatening episodes. At 4, he had joyfully eaten a peanut butter sandwich that had precipitated a coma. In 1993, when Gelsinger was 12 years old, two pediatricians in Pennsylvania, Mark Batshaw and James Wilson, began to experiment with gene therapy to cure children with OTC deficiencies. A former college-level football player, Wilson was a risk-taker fascinated by ambitious human experiments. He had formed a gene therapy company named Genova and an Institute for Human Gene Therapy at the University of Pennsylvania. Both Wilson and Batshaw were intrigued by OTC deficiency. As with ADA deficiency, that OTC is caused by the dysfunction of a single gene made the illness an ideal test case for gene therapy. But the form of gene therapy that Wilson and Batshaw envisioned was vastly more radical. Rather than extracting cells, genetically modifying them, and injecting them back into children, a la Anderson and Blaze, Batshaw and Wilson imagined inserting the corrected gene directly back into the body via a virus. This would not be gene therapy light. They would create a virus carrying the OTC gene and deliver the virus into the liver through the bloodstream, leaving the virus to infect cells in situ. The virus-infected liver cells would start synthesizing the OTC enzyme, Batshaw and Wilson reasoned, and thus correct the enzyme deficiency. The telltale sign would be a reduction of ammonia in the blood. It wasn't that subtle, Wilson recalls. To deliver the gene, Wilson and Batshaw chose adenovirus, a virus that typically causes a common cold but is not associated with any severe disease. It seemed like a safe, reasonable choice, the blandest of viruses used as the vehicle for one of the boldest human genetic experiments of the decade. In the summer of 1993, Batshaw and Wilson began to inject the modified adenovirus into mice and monkeys. The mouse experiments worked as predicted. The virus reached the liver cells, disgorged the gene, and transformed the cells into microscopic factories for the functional OTC enzyme. But the monkey experiments were more complicated. At higher doses of the virus, an occasional monkey raised a brisk immune response to the virus, resulting in inflammation and liver failure. One monkey hemorrhaged to death. Wilson and Batshaw modified the virus, shaving off many of the viral genes that might elicit immunity to make it a safer gene delivery vehicle. They also reduced the potential human dose by 17-fold to doubly ensure the safety of the virus. In 1997, they applied to the Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee, the gatekeeper for all gene therapy experiments, for approval for a human trial. The RAC was resistant at first, but it too had changed. In the decade between the ADA trial and Wilson's, the once fierce guardian of recombinant DNA had turned into an enthusiastic cheerleader of human gene therapy. The fizz of enthusiasm had even leached beyond the committee. Asked by the RAC to comment on Wilson's trial, bioethicists argued that treating children with full-blown OTC deficiency might result in coercion. What parent wouldn't want to try a breakthrough therapy that might work on a dying child? Instead, ethicists recommended a trial on normal volunteers and patients with mild variants of OTC, such as Jesse Gelsinger. In Arizona, Gelsinger, meanwhile, was chafing against the elaborate restrictions on his diet and medications. All teenagers rebel, Gelsinger's father Paul told me, but teenage rebellion might feel particularly acute when it involves a hamburger and a glass of milk. In the summer of 1998, when he was 17, Gelsinger learned of the OTC trial at the University of Pennsylvania. Gelsinger was gripped by the thought of gene therapy. He wanted a respite from the grinding routine of his life. But what got him even more excited, his father recalled, was the idea that he was doing it for the babies. How do you say no to that? Gelsinger could hardly wait to sign on. In June 1999, he contacted the Pennsylvania team through his local doctors to enroll in the trial. That month, Paul and Jesse Gelsinger flew to Philadelphia to meet Wilson and Batshaw. Jesse and Paul were both impressed. The trial struck Paul Gelsinger as a beautiful, beautiful thing. They visited the hospital and then wandered through the city in a haze of excitement and anticipation. Jesse stopped in front of the Rocky Balboa bronze outside the Spectrum Arena. Paul snapped a picture of his son, his arms raised in a boxer's victory stance. On September 9th, Jesse returned to Philadelphia with a duffel bag filled with clothes, books, and wrestling videos to start the trial at University Hospital. Jesse would stay with his uncle and cousins in the city and admit himself to the hospital on the appointed morning. The procedure was described as so quick and painless that Paul planned to pick up his son 1 week after the therapy had been completed to bring him back home on a commercial flight. On the morning of September 13th, the day chosen for the viral injection, Gelsinger's ammonia level was found to be hovering around 70 micromoles per liter, twice the normal level and at the upper edge of the cutoff value for the trial. The nurses brought news of the abnormal lab to Wilson and Batshaw. The protocol, meanwhile, was in full swing. The operating rooms were on standby. The viral liquid had been thawed and sat glistening in its plastic pouch. Wilson and Batshaw debated Gelsinger's eligibility, but decided that it was clinically safe to continue. The previous 17 patients had, after all, tolerated the injection. At about 9:30 a.m., Gelsinger was wheeled down to the interventional radiology suite. He was sedated, and two large catheters were snaked through his legs to reach an artery close to the liver. Around 11 a.m., a surgeon drew about 30 milliliters from a bag clouded with the concentrated adenovirus and injected the puff of virus into Gelsinger's artery. Hundreds of millions of invisible infectious particles carrying the OTC gene streamed into the liver. By noon, the procedure was done. The afternoon was uneventful. That evening, back in his hospital room, Gelsinger spiked a fever to 104 degrees. His face was flushed. Wilson and Batchel did not make much of the symptoms. The other patients had also experienced transient fevers. Jesse called Paul in Arizona on the phone and said, "I love you," before hanging up and drawing up his covers in bed. He slept fitfully through the night. The next morning, a nurse noted that Jesse's eyeballs had turned the palest shade of yellow. A test confirmed that bilirubin, a product made in the liver and also stored in red blood cells, was spilling into his blood. The elevated bilirubin meant one of two things: either the liver was being injured or blood cells were being damaged. Both were ominous signs. In any other human, the small bump in cellular breakdown or liver failure might have been shrugged off, but in a patient with OTC deficiency, the combination of these two injuries might spark a perfect storm. The extra protein leaching out from the blood cells would not be metabolized, and the damaged liver, deficient in protein metabolism even in the best of times, would be even less capable of processing the excess protein load. The body would intoxicate itself on its own poisons. By noon, Gelsinger's ammonia level had climbed to a staggering 393 micromoles per liter, nearly 10 times the normal level. Paul Gelsinger and Mark Batchel were alerted. James Wilson heard the news from the surgeon who had inserted the catheter and injected the virus. Paul booked a red-eye to Pennsylvania, while a team of doctors swooped into the ICU to begin dialysis to avert a coma. At 8 o'clock the next morning, when Paul Gelsinger reached the hospital, Jesse was hyperventilating and confused. His kidneys were failing. The ICU team sedated him to try to use a mechanical ventilator to stabilize his breathing. Late that night, his lungs began to stiffen and collapse, filling up with fluids from the inflammatory response. The ventilator faltered, unable to push enough oxygen in, and so Jesse was hooked up to a device to force oxygen directly into the blood. His brain function was also deteriorating. A neurologist was called to examine him and noted Jesse's downcasting eyes, a sign of damage to the brain. The next morning, Hurricane Floyd struck the East Coast, battering the shores of Pennsylvania and Maryland with shrieking winds and torrents of rain. Batchel was stuck on a train getting to the hospital. He ran down the last minutes of his cell phone's battery talking to the nurses and doctors, then sat in the pitch darkness, stewing with anxiety. By the late afternoon, Jesse's condition worsened again. His kidneys shut down. His coma deepened. Stranded in his hotel room with no taxi in sight, Paul Gelsinger walked a mile and a half through the whistling storm to the hospital to see Jesse in the ICU. He found his son unrecognizable, comatose, swollen, bruised, yellowed with jaundice, with dozens of lines and catheters crisscrossing his body. The ventilator puffed ineffectually against his inflamed lungs with the flat, dull sound of wind slapping water. The room buzzed and beeped with hundreds of instruments recording the slow decline of a boy in desperate physiological distress. On the morning of Friday, September 17th, on the fourth day after the gene delivery, Jesse was found to be brain dead. Paul Gelsinger decided to withdraw life support. The chaplain came into the hospital room and put his hand on Jesse's head, anointing it with oil, and read the Lord's Prayer. The machines were shut off one by one. The room fell into silence, except for Jesse's deep, agonal breaths At 2:30 p.m., Jesse's heart stopped. He was officially pronounced dead. How could such a beautiful thing go so, so wrong? When I spoke to Paul Gelsinger in the summer of 2014, he was still searching for an answer. A few weeks earlier, I had emailed Paul about my interest in Jesse's story. Gelsinger spoke to me on the phone, then agreed to meet me after my talk on the future of genetics and cancer at an open forum in Scottsdale, Arizona. While I stood in the lobby of the auditorium at the end of the talk, a man in a Hawaiian shirt with Jesse's round, open face, a face that I remembered vividly from pictures on the web, pushed his way through the crowd and extended his hand. In the aftermath of Jesse's death, Paul has become a one-man crusader against the overreach of clinical experimentation. He is not against medicine or innovation. He believes in the future of gene therapy, but he is suspicious of the hyperbaric atmosphere of enthusiasm and delusion that ultimately resulted in his son's death. The crowd thinned and Paul turned around to leave. An acknowledgement passed between us, a doctor writing about the future of medicine and genetics, and a man whose story had been etched into its past. There was the infinite horizon of grief in his voice. "They didn't have a handle on it yet," he said. "They tried it too quickly. They tried it without doing it right. They rushed this thing. They really rushed it." The autopsy of an experiment gone so, so wrong began in earnest in October 1999 when the University of Pennsylvania launched an investigation into the OTC trial. By late October, an investigative journalist from the Washington Post had picked up the news of Gelsinger's death, and the tide of furor broke loose. In November, the U.S. Senate, the House of Representatives, and the District Attorney of Pennsylvania held independent hearings on Jesse Gelsinger's death. By December, the RAC and the FDA had launched an investigation of the University of Pennsylvania. Gelsinger's medical records, the pretrial animal experiments, consent forms, procedure notes, lab tests, and the records of all the other patients on the gene therapy trial were pulled up from University Hospital's basement, and federal regulators plowed their way through the mounds of paper trying to exhume the cause of the boy's death. The initial analysis revealed a damning pattern of incompetence, blunders, and neglect, compounded by fundamental gaps in knowledge. First, the animal experiments performed to establish the safety of the adenovirus had been performed hastily. One monkey inoculated with the highest doses of the virus had died, and while this death had been reported to the NIH and the dose reduced for human patients, no mention of the death was found in the forms given to the Gelsinger family. Nothing about the consent forms, Paul Gelsinger recalled, hinted clearly at the harm that the treatment could cause. It was portrayed like a perfect gamble, all upside and no downside. Second, even the human patients treated before Jesse had experienced side effects, some striking enough to have halted the trial or triggered reevaluations of the protocol. Fevers, inflammatory responses, and early signs of liver failure had been recorded, but these too had been underreported or ignored. That Wilson had a financial stake in the biotechnology company that stood to benefit from this gene therapy experiment only further deepened the suspicion that the trial had been put together with inappropriate incentives. The pattern of neglect was so damning that it nearly obscured the most important scientific lessons of the trial. Even if the doctors admitted that they had been negligent and impatient, Gelsinger's death was still a mystery. No one could explain why Jesse Gelsinger had suffered such a severe immune reaction to the virus, while the 17 other patients had not. Clearly, the adenoviral vector, even the third-generation virus shorn of some of its immunogenic proteins, was capable of inciting a severe idiosyncratic response in some patients. The autopsy of Gelsinger's body showed that his physiology had become overwhelmed by this immune response. Notably, when his blood was analyzed, antibodies highly reactive to the virus were found dating from even before the viral injection. Gelsinger's hyperactive immune response was likely related to prior exposure to a similar strain of adenovirus, possibly from a common cold. Exposures to pathogens are well known to incite antibodies that remain in circulation for decades. This, after all, is how most vaccines work. In Jesse's case, this prior exposure had likely triggered a hyperactive immune response that had spiraled out of control for unknown reasons. Ironically, perhaps the choice of a harmless, common virus as the initial vector for gene therapy had turned out to be the trial's key failing. What, then, was the appropriate vector for gene therapy? what kind of virus could be used to deliver genes safely into humans, and which organs were appropriate targets. Just as the field of gene therapy was beginning to confront its most intriguing scientific problems, the entire discipline was placed under a strict moratorium. The litany of troubles uncovered in the OTC trial was not limited to that trial alone. In January 2000, when the FDA inspected 28 other trials, nearly half of them required immediate remedial action. Justifiably alarmed, the FDA shut down nearly all the trials. The entire field of gene therapy went into free fall, a journalist wrote. Wilson was banned from working on FDA-regulated human clinical trials for 5 years. He stepped down from his position at the helm of the Institute for Human Gene Therapy, remaining as a professor at Penn. Soon afterward, the institute itself was gone. In September 1999, a gene therapy looked to be on the cusp of a breakthrough in medicine. By the end of 2000, it seemed like a cautionary tale of scientific overreach. Or, as Ruth Macklin, the bioethicist, put it bluntly, gene therapy is not yet therapy. In science, there is a well-known aphorism that the most beautiful theory can be slayed by an ugly fact. In medicine, the same aphorism takes a somewhat different form. A beautiful therapy can be killed by an ugly trial. In retrospect, the OTC trial was nothing short of ugly, hurriedly designed, poorly planned, badly monitored, abysmally delivered. It was made twice as hideous by the financial conflicts involved. The profits were in it for profits. But the basic concept behind the trial, delivering genes into human bodies or cells to correct genetic defects, was conceptually sound, as it had been for decades. In principle, the capacity to deliver genes into cells using viruses or other gene vectors should have led to powerful new medical technologies, had the scientific and financial ambitions of the early proponents of gene therapy not gotten in the way. Gene therapy would eventually become therapy. It would rebound from the ugliness of the initial trials and learn the moral lessons implicit in the cautionary tale of scientific overreach. But it would take yet another decade and a lot more learning for the science to cross the breach. Genetic diagnosis, previvors. All that man is, all mere complexities. W.B. Yeats, Byzantium. The anti-determinists want to say that DNA is a little sideshow, but every disease that's with us is caused by DNA, and every disease can be fixed by DNA. George Church. While human gene therapy was exiled to wander its scientific tundra in the late 1990s, human genetic diagnosis experienced a remarkable renaissance. To understand this renaissance, we need to return to the future's future envisioned by Berg students on the ramparts of the Sicilian castle. As the students had imagined it, the future of human genetics would be built on two fundamental elements. The first was genetic diagnosis, the idea that genes could be used to predict or determine illness, identity, choice, and destiny. The second was genetic alteration, that genes could be changed to change the future of diseases, choice, and destiny. This second project, the intentional alteration of genes, writing the genome, had evidently faltered with the abrupt ban on gene therapy trials. But the first, predicting future fate from genes, reading the genome, only gained more strength. In the decade following Jesse Gelsinger's death, geneticists uncovered scores of genes linked to some of the most complex and mysterious human diseases, illnesses for which genes had never been implicated as primary causes. These discoveries would enable the development of immensely powerful new technologies that would allow for the preemptive diagnosis of illness, but they would also force genetics and medicine to confront some of the deepest medical and moral conundrums in their history. Genetic tests, as Eric Topol, the medical geneticist, described it, are also moral tests. When you decide to test for future risk, you are also inevitably asking yourself, what kind of future am I willing to risk? Three case studies illustrate the power and the peril of using genes to predict future risk. The first involves the breast cancer gene BRCA1. In the early 1970s, the geneticist Mary Claire King began to study the inheritance of breast and ovarian cancer in large families. A mathematician by training, King had met Alan Wilson, the man who had dreamed up mitochondrial Eve, at the University of California, Berkeley, and switched to the study of genes and the reconstruction of genetic lineages. King's earlier studies performed in Wilson's lab had demonstrated that chimps and humans shared more than 90% genetic identity. After graduate school, King turned to a different sort of genetic history, reconstructing the lineages of human diseases. Breast cancer, in particular, intrigued her. Decades of careful studies on families had suggested that breast cancer came in two forms, sporadic and familial. In sporadic breast cancer, the illness appears in women without any family history. In familial breast cancer, the cancer courses through families across multiple generations. In a typical pedigree, a woman, her sister, her daughter, and her granddaughter might be affected, although the precise age of diagnosis and the precise stage of cancer for each individual might differ. The increased incidence of breast cancer in some of these families is often accompanied by a striking increase in the incidence of ovarian cancer, suggesting a mutation that is common to both forms of cancer. In 1978, when the National Cancer Institute launched a survey on breast cancer patients, there was widespread disagreement about the cause of the disease. One camp of cancer experts argued that breast cancer was caused by a chronic viral infection, triggered by the overuse of oral contraceptives. Others blamed stress and diet. King asked to have two questions added to the survey. Did the patient have a family history of breast cancer? Was there a family history of ovarian cancer? By the end of the survey, the genetic connection vaulted out of the study. She had identified several families with deep histories of both breast and ovarian cancer. Between 1978 and 1988, King added hundreds of such families to her list and compiled enormous pedigrees of women with breast cancer. In one family with more than 150 members, she found 30 women affected by the illness. A closer analysis of all the pedigrees suggested that a single gene was responsible for many of the familial cases, but identifying the gene was not easy. Although the culprit gene increased the cancer risk among carriers by more than tenfold, not everyone who inherited the gene had cancer. The breast cancer gene, King found, had incomplete penetrance. Even if the gene was mutated, its effect did not always fully penetrate into every individual to cause a symptom, that is, breast or ovarian cancer. Despite the confounding effect of penetrance, King's collection of cases was so large that she could use linkage analysis across multiple families, crossing multiple generations, to narrow the location of the gene to chromosome 17. By 1988, she had zoomed in farther on the gene. She had pinpointed it to a region on chromosome 17 called 17q21. The gene was still a hypothesis, she said, but at least it had a known physical presence on a human chromosome. Being comfortable with uncertainty for years was the lesson of the Wilson lab, and it is an essential part of what we do. She called the gene BRCA1, even though she had yet to isolate it. The narrowing down of the chromosomal locus of BRCA1 launched a furious race to identify the gene. In the early 90s, teams of geneticists across the globe, including King, set out to clone BRCA1. New technologies such as the polymerase chain reaction, PCR, allowed researchers to make millions of copies of a gene in a test tube. These techniques, coupled with deft gene cloning, gene sequencing, and gene mapping methods, made it possible to move rapidly from a chromosomal position to a gene. In 1994, a private company in Utah named Myriad Genetics announced the isolation of the BRCA1 gene. In 1998, Myriad was granted a patent for the BRCA1 sequence, one of the first ever patents issued on a human gene sequence. For Myriad, the real use of BRCA1 in clinical medicine was genetic testing. In 1996, even before the patent on the gene had been granted, the company began marketing a genetic test for BRCA1. The test was simple. A woman at risk would be evaluated by a genetic counselor. If the family history was suggestive of breast cancer, a swab of cells from her mouth would be sent to a central lab. The lab would amplify parts of her BRCA1 gene using the polymerase chain reaction, sequence the parts, and identify the mutant genes. It would report back normal, mutant, or indeterminate. Some unusual mutations have not yet been fully categorized for breast cancer risk. In the summer of 2008, I met a woman with a family history of breast cancer. Jane Sterling was a 37-year-old nurse from the North Shore of Massachusetts. The story of her family could have been plucked straight out of Mary Claire King's case files. A great-grandmother with breast cancer at an early age, a grandmother who had a radical mastectomy for cancer at 45, a mother who had had bilateral breast cancer at 60. Sterling had two daughters. She had known about BRCA1 testing for nearly a decade. When her first daughter was born, she had considered the test but neglected to follow up. With the birth of the second daughter and the diagnosis of breast cancer in a close friend, she came to terms with gene testing. Sterling tested positive for a BRCA1 mutation. 2 weeks later, she returned to the clinic armed with sheaves of papers scribbled with questions. What would she do with the knowledge of her diagnosis? Women with BRCA1 have an 80% lifetime risk of breast cancer. But the genetic test tells a woman nothing about when she might develop the cancer, nor the kind of cancer that she might have. Since the BRCA1 mutation has incomplete penetrance, a woman with the mutation might develop inoperable, aggressive, therapy-resistant breast cancer at age 30. She might develop a therapy-sensitive variant at age 50, or a smoldering, indolent variant at age 75, or she might not develop cancer at all. When should she tell her daughters about the diagnosis? Some of these women with BRCA1 mutations hate their mothers, one writer, who tested positive herself, wrote. The hatred of mothers alone illuminates the chronic misunderstanding of genetics and its debilitating effects on the human psyche. The mutant BRCA1 gene is as likely to be inherited from a mother as it is from a father. Would Sterling inform her sisters, her aunts, her second cousins? The uncertainties about outcome were compounded by uncertainties about the choices of therapy. Sterling could choose to do nothing, to watch and wait. She could choose to have bilateral mastectomies and/or ovary removal to sharply diminish her risk of breast and ovarian cancer. Cutting off her breasts to spite her genes, as one woman with a BRCA1 mutation described it. She could seek intensive screening with mammograms, self-examination, and MRIs to detect early breast cancer. Or she could choose to take a hormonal medicine such as tamoxifen, which would decrease the risk of some, but not all, breast cancer. Part of the reason for this vast variation in outcome reflects the fundamental biology of BRCA1. The gene encodes a protein that plays a critical role in the repair of damaged DNA. For a cell, a broken DNA strand is a catastrophe in the making. It signals the loss of information, a crisis. Soon after DNA damage, the BRCA1 protein is recruited to the broken edges to repair the gap. In patients with the normal gene, the protein launches a chain reaction, recruiting dozens of proteins to the knife edge of the broken gene to swiftly plug the breach. In patients with the mutated gene, however, the mutant BRCA1 is not appropriately recruited, and the breaks are not repaired. The mutation thus permits more mutations, like fire fueling fire, until the growth regulatory and metabolic controls on the cell are snapped, ultimately leading to breast cancer. Breast cancer, even in BRCA1 mutated patients, requires multiple triggers. The environment clearly plays a role. Add X-rays or a DNA damaging agent, and the mutation rate climbs even higher. Chance plays a role since the mutations that accumulate are random, and other genes accelerate or mitigate the effects of BRCA1. Genes involved in repair of the DNA or the recruitment of the BRCA1 protein to the broken strand. The BRCA1 mutation thus predicts a future, but not in the sense that a mutation in the cystic fibrosis gene or Huntington's disease gene predicts the future. The future of a woman carrying a BRCA1 mutation is fundamentally changed by that knowledge, and yet it remains just as fundamentally uncertain. For some women, the genetic diagnosis is all-consuming. It is as if their lives and energies are spent anticipating cancer and imagining survivorship from an illness that they have not yet developed. A disturbing new word with a distinctly Orwellian ring has been coined to describe these women. Previvors. Pre-survivors. The second case study of genetic diagnosis concerns schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. It brings us full circle in our story. In 1908, the Swiss-German psychiatrist Eugen Bleuler introduced the term schizophrenia to describe patients with a unique mental illness characterized by a terrifying form of cognitive disintegration, the collapse of thinking. Previously called dementia praecox, precocious madness, schizophrenics were often young men who experienced a gradual but irreversible breakdown in their cognitive abilities. They heard spectral voices from within, commanding them